this hour. China says the security partnership between Australia, Britain, and the U.S. poses a regional and global threat. Lebanon's resistance movement Hezbollah condemns Australia's decision to list it as a terrorist organization, calls it a blind bias in the service of Israeli interests. And German parties say that they've reached a deal to form a coalition government that will bring an end to Chancellor Angela Merkel's era. Welcome to our studios near the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. China has criticized the recently inked security partnership between Australia, the UK, and the US, saying that it poses both a regional and global threat.
The nuclear submarine cooperation is not merely a matter between a small number of countries. It does not harm the interests of one party alone. This cooperation may cause negative consequences and pose threats to the entire region and the world.
Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman also urged Canberra, London, and Washington to abandon, quote, their Cold War zero-sum mentality and work towards safeguarding regional peace and stability. He said that the three countries should also fulfill their international nuclear non-proliferation obligations. The trilateral security pact known as AUKUS has sparked regional worries since it allows Australia to acquire nuclear-powered submarines with technology and assistance from the U.S. and the U.K. The new pact prompted Australia to cancel a mega-submarine deal with France, a move that enraged Paris. It has also riled China, the major rising power in the Indo-Pacific region. The Russian defense minister says that his country needs to further boost its military in the face of what he calls increased NATO activities on its borders. Sergei Shoigu said the Russian armed forces should increase their effectiveness. He added that the other priorities should be to maintain the combat readiness of nuclear forces and to strengthen the potential of non-nuclear deterrent forces. The remarks followed warnings by Western countries over Russia's alleged military activities along its border with Ukraine. The U.S. also said that its real concern is a new buildup of Russian forces on the border. Moscow has dismissed Western claims that Russia may be preparing to invade Ukraine. It says the military buildup is in response to growing NATO activities on its borders. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has condemned Australia's move to classify it as a terrorist organization. Hezbollah, in a statement, called the designation a, quote, blind bias in the service of Israeli interests. It said the latest decision, as well as those previously taken by some Western governments, affect neither the Lebanese nation's spirit nor the resistance movement's positions. Hezbollah also noted that the move by Australia or any other Western government has no effect on its determination to support any anti-Israeli movements. Australia has blacklisted Hezbollah, extending a ban on its armed factions to the entire movement. Outrage against the UK decision to declare Hamas a terrorist organization keeps pouring in. Now representatives of Palestinian resistance groups in Tehran have called on the international community to take serious measures against London's decision. Salman Khoudry has more from the Iranian capital, Tehran.
Representatives of Palestinian resistance groups in Tehran have held a press conference to elaborate on the goals behind the UK decision to declare Hamas as a terrorist organization. Representative of Hamas in Tehran, Khaled Al-Qadoumi, said the recent decision by Britain is politically motivated. He further said the UK has always supported the Zionist regime, and Britain and global arrogance are to be blamed for all the crimes and brutalities against the Palestinians.
When they have themselves commented on this announcement, in this condemned announcement, they said that Hamas has to engage politically. So it tells you directly that this is a political decision. It has nothing to do with the Hamas ideology or Hamas behavior. Hence, we in Palestine reject and straightforward condemn this resolution. We do not accept it. This does not represent the actual and real crux of the human notion and democracy. We are a democratically elected movement. We are representing our own people, and the whole Palestinian arena, in Foreign Ministry of Palestine, ambassadors of Palestinian authorities, Palestinian factions, They have condemned this resolution.
Meanwhile, representative of Palestinian Islamic Jihad movement in Tehran called on the international community to take more serious action in condemnation of the UK decision against Hamas.
We urge the international community to take a serious action against the recent UK decision to declare Hamas as a terrorist organization. Resistance is the legitimate right of Palestinians to defend themselves. We call on all freedom seekers around the world to stand against such a move by global arrogance.
Recently, the British Home Secretary announced that she was seeking to declare the whole of Islamic resistance movement, Hamas, a terrorist organization. Meanwhile, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian condemned Britain's move, saying the rights of Palestinians cannot be trampled on by distorting facts. In a statement, Hamas responded by asserting that instead of apologizing and correcting its historical sin against the Palestinian people, Britain supports the aggressors at the expense of the victims.
Palestinian groups believe that the recent UK decision is an unfortunate continuation of London's bias in favor of the Israeli regime and its policies, which are based on terror, massacre, and destruction. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Syrian media say that Israel's latest aerial aggression against the Arab country has claimed 2 civilian lives. Several people were also injured in the early morning attack on the central province of Homs. Reports say the Syrian air defenses, however, intercepted most of the incoming missiles. Meanwhile, the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the attack, calling the Israeli aggression a crime and an act of intimidation. Hamas spokesman Hazem Qassam noted that Israel's logic of coercion and bullying must be confronted in order to prevent the regime's hostile and aggressive behaviors. Israel frequently strikes targets inside of Syria. Last week, it launched a missile strike against the capital, Damascus. The Syrian government accuses Tel Aviv of supporting terrorist groups that are operating on its soil. Saudi Arabia continues its military aggression against neighboring Yemen, bringing more deaths and devastation to the impoverished nation. Yemeni media reports say that one person was killed and 3 others injured after the kingdom's air and artillery units targeted border areas. Earlier on Wednesday, Saudi warplanes also bombed 2 districts of the capital, Sana'a, leaving 2 civilians dead and 2 others injured. The attacks come as the United Nations has projected that the death toll from the ongoing onslaught on Yemen could surpass 377,000 by the end of the year. The World Bodies Development Program says that the war kills a Yemeni child every 9 minutes. The UN has already described Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. U.S. Special Envoy for Iran says Washington will not, quote, sit idly if Tehran drags its feet on returning to compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal. In a radio interview, Rob Malley also threatened that the U.S. would respond accordingly if Iran accelerated the pace of its nuclear program. He also talked about diplomatic and other efforts without elaborating further. Malley said, however, that the U.S. is thinking foremost of economic pressure on Iran. The statements came just days ahead of new talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal in Vienna on November 29th. Tehran has repeatedly called on the U.S. to stop issuing threats and to focus on removing anti-Iran sanctions if it really wants to return to the deal. The Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency says that his latest negotiations with Iranian officials in Tehran over the country's nuclear program were inconclusive. Rafael Grossi made the remark at the start of the quarterly meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors. He also criticized Iran for denying the agency's access to a nuclear facility in the city of Karach near Tehran. Grossi said time is running out for the UN nuclear watchdog to reach an agreement to end the standoff over reinstalling surveillance cameras at the facility that makes parts for centrifuges. The Karach site came under a sabotage attack in June, which Iran blames on Israel. Iran says the site is off-limits as long as the attack is being investigated by judicial and security officials. Germany is inching closer to a new coalition government 2 months after the country's parliamentary elections. The center-left Social Democratic Party, the environmentalist Green Party, and the business-focused Free Democrats have agreed to form a coalition. Each of the parties has to ratify the coalition agreements before a new cabinet is formed. The post of the chancellorship is slated to go to Olaf Scholz from the Social Democrats, the party which won the highest number of seats in September's elections. The Greens will be in charge of a new ministry dealing with climate, as well as a foreign ministry. And the Free Democratic Party will head the powerful finance ministry. The new government is expected to start its work in December, pending a parliamentary approval. Sweden's first female prime minister-elect, Magdalena Andersson, has resigned just hours after her appointment by parliament. Andersson tendered her resignation after her budget failed to pass and the junior Greens party left the coalition government. Greens left the coalition with Social Democrats in their opposition to the amendments in the 2022 budget by the opposition. Andersson cited constitutional practice for quitting her job before the oath, saying that she does not want to lead a government whose legitimacy will be questioned, but she hopes to be elected to the position again. Andersson says she is ready to lead a minority government made up of only the Social Democrats. The Turkish lira nosedives 15%, hitting a record low against the U.S. dollar. Economists blame the crisis on the government's new policy to lower the interest rates. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, however, blames foreign countries for the economic situation and a sudden drop in the lira value. Russian Saglam has filed this report from Istanbul.
The Turkish lira crashed on Tuesday by 15% against the U.S. dollars. Economists blame a new Turkish government's plan to cut interest rates aimed at resolving the economic crisis Ankara is facing. President Erdogan has forced the central bank to cut interest rates three times. This year, the lira shed 45% of its value, with investors losing their confidence in the Turkish currency and the country's economy. Turkish president blames foreign countries for the lira crash, saying the high interest rate would not lower inflation.
Ülkemizi.
I reject policies that contract our country, weaken it, condemn our people to unemployment, hunger and poverty. We see the game played over the currency, interest and price hikes. We will show our will to proceed with our own game plan. We are fighting an economic war of independence.
Critics say the ruling party is getting the country involved in what they call hazardous economic experiment. They call on the government to abandon such irrational actions immediately and return to policies aimed at protecting the Turkish lira's value.
The Turkish government has implemented a policy to protect the economy from high interest rates. That's why they want to lower the interest rates. But it has caused very high raises in the currencies because of high inflation rate in Turkey. This is a very risky approach. Erdogan says he's intentionally doing this. He says he's doing it to have independent, stronger economy. However, the cut in the interest rates is the reason for this crisis, nothing else. International markets also affect the currency rate, but it's mainly due to the government policies in Turkey.
People have taken to the streets, both in Ankara and Istanbul, calling on the AK ruling party and President Erdogan to step down. Demonstrators say the drop in lira is affecting their daily life, as everything is becoming more and more expensive. The drop in lira affects Turkish people's daily lives, with many considering the ruling party not being able to contain the crisis, which would probably affect poor results in the upcoming elections. Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Indian authorities in Indian-controlled Kashmir have allocated 65.5 acres of land to their paramilitary forces. Well, the move has drawn strong condemnations from Kashmiris who view the allocation as a prelude to drive them out of their ancestral lands. Shana Butt has more.
In the southern district of Indian-controlled Kashmir's Pulwama, Farida Bano grows vegetables to sustain her family. For decades, this family has survived on the small farmland, which is surrounded by a huge agricultural land.
This land is the only source of our income. I have three daughters and my husband is suffering from a brain tumor. We live from hand to mouth just by this piece of land.
Farida says her family has lost the peace since the government authorities decided to transfer this land to the paramilitary troops. In a recent move, New Delhi has transferred over 65.5 acres of Kashmir's land to its paramilitary forces and their families stationed in the valley region. This piece of land between Oku village and the Sitargund village is the source of livelihood for some 800 families. For decades, these people have been using this land for agricultural production.
I remember my father and his father plowing this land for decades. Sheikh Abdullah, the then Prime Minister of Kashmir, ordered people to make use of free land for agricultural purposes so that we become self-sufficient. And now they are evicting us from the same land, calling it a barren state land.
Of Officials say the land will be transferred against the payment as per the stamp duty rates notified for the year 2021. The farmers say the government should reconsider this decision, keeping in view the survival of its inhabitants.
The Indian government snatched our special status and promised many hollow things in return. Today, it is clear that the eviction is the fallout of scrapping Article 370. They are bringing people from other parts of India to settle here at the cost of our survival.
The deputy village head says for decades these people have been paying taxes for cultivating this land, and due to lack of education, they haven't done any legal process for possession of this land.
This land is fertile, providing our farmers with their basic needs. The majority of people here are farmers. What else can they do for survival? The government must change its decision.
Farida says it has been weeks since the family has slept well, thinking where to go and how to survive.
Since New Delhi stripped Kashmir's special status in August 2019 and later amended the land laws permitting any Indian to buy land in Indian-administered Kashmir, the residents of Kashmir are skeptical of government's intention of settling outsiders here and to change the demographics of this Muslim-majority region. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
And that is it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
What about you? IRIB English Radio. To our website www.parstoday.com/en.
A new Mint Press news study based on Department of Defense documents can reveal that U.S. weapons manufacturers have sold well in excess of $28.3 billion worth of arms to Saudi Arabia since the Yemen war began, including 20 separate deals inked during Biden's presidency. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Alan McLeod, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Despite Pledge, Biden Leaves Tap Open, Approving Billions in Arms Deals to Saudi Arabia. Stay tuned, please, for the first part of this article. The war in Yemen must end, declared President Joe Biden in his first major foreign policy speech, And to underscore our commitment, we are ending all American support for offensive Saudi operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales, unquote. Yet, studying sales records from the U.S. Department of Defense, DOD, Minpress can reveal that less than 1 year into his presidency, the Biden administration has already approved 20 separate weapons contracts worth just shy of $1.2 billion to Saudi Arabia alone. This includes a $100 million shipment of Black Hawk helicopters, support for Apache gunships, and a $78 million deal to buy 36 cruise missiles. A new and controversial $650 million deal announced earlier this month has yet to be finalized, but will likely soon follow, boosting sales up to levels equal with the earlier years of the Trump presidency. The Saudi-led coalition is once again pummeling Yemen's capital, Sana'a. Images appear to show U.S.-made aircraft attacking ground targets. This is hardly surprising. American arms sales to Saudi Arabia have long been a point of contention. But this Minpress investigation will reveal the extent to which private American companies are profiting off the infliction of suffering on the Yemeni people. Sorting through thousands of approved contracts, the Department of Defense has approved in excess of $28.4 billion worth of sales from American companies to the armed forces of Saudi Arabia since they began their military intervention in the Yemeni war in March 2015. This includes billions of dollars worth of arms, supplies, logistical support, and training services. While this is a gargantuan number, already larger than Yemen's gross domestic product, it is certainly a serious underestimate of just how much the military-industrial complex is benefiting from what the United Nations has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. In addition to the $28 billion figure, Saudi Arabia is also a named customer, often along with other nations, in weapons deals worth more than $34 billion over the same period. However, the amounts the Saudis actually paid in these were not disclosed, though in some of these orders, Saudi Arabia was clearly the primary buyer. For example, a $3.4 billion DOD-approved radar deal with Raytheon lists only two buyers, Saudi Arabia and the tiny nation of Kuwait with a population of 4.2 million. Together, this means that the DOD has green-lighted the sale of somewhere between $28 billion and $63 billion worth of arms from American companies to Saudi Arabia since the latter began its attack on the largely civilian population of Yemen. Of course, the U.S. was supplying the Saudis well before the war started and also continues to sell billions of dollars worth of weapons to other partners in the Saudi war on Yemen, such as Bahrain, Qatar, and the UAE. Therefore, this number only begins to tell the story of corporate American war profiteering. Selling weapons of war to such a repressive government was already ethically questionable. By March 2015, there was no way one could credibly argue that arms sales to Saudi Arabia would be used in a purely defensive manner. Nevertheless, they continued to grow, fueling the violence. From March to December 2015, sales to Saudi Arabia totaled $1.56 billion. But under Trump, that number ballooned to $5.47 billion in 2019 and $14.36 billion in 2020. Facing increased opposition even inside Washington, Trump even used his presidential veto to unblock an $8.1 billion deal. Although the Biden administration has not overseen the bonanza fire sale its predecessors oversaw, the flow of arms has not stopped. President Biden said, "We are going to see an end to U.S. complicity in the Saudi war and blockade on Yemen." Unfortunately, this new $650 million weapon sales perpetuates both the war and the blockade that's pushing millions of Yemenis into famine, said Hassan Al-Tayeb, legislative director for Middle East Policy at the Friends Committee on National Legislation, a pro-peace lobbying group associated with the Quaker movement, adding, "These air-to-air munitions, combined with other forms of military aid, send a message of impunity to the Saudis as they continue their destructive behavior in Yemen with no consequences from key allies like the United States. Now is not the time to be green-lighting new arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Now is the time to use existing U.S. leverage to end the Saudi blockade before more Yemenis are plunged into famine."
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you.
From Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. Dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I hope you have started a beautiful day. We are here to present you with another beautiful episode of the program Muslim Lady. I'm Farman Ali Masumi, and with me,
Razia Batul Najafi is here. Thank you so much.
Yeah, it's a very, very wonderful opportunity for us to be here and present some of the beautiful ahadith and viewpoints of our Aima Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, to share them with our dear listeners. So we were discussing about the modesty in our social media. This is a very, very important topic.
I think every single person needs it. Every day, if someone would remind us, that would be even less. Yeah. We need more than that. So usually we as a women, constantly we need a reminder of modesty, chastity, shamefulness, like the respect of, you know, self-respect, especially in social media.
Yeah, because nowadays, you know, the technology has grown very, very fast, you know, and it has become part of every single person's life. So, you know, this is a very big issue. We have to know how to deal with it. You know, as a hadith say that your eyes is an arrow for shaitan. Yeah, an-nazaru sahmun min sahami shayateen, or shaitan. So likewise, this social media can be a trap for shaitan.
Exactly.
So we have to know the limits, we have to know the boundaries, and we have to know how to deal with it and how to use it.
Yeah, because that this is a part important. Of our life, as you have told us, that we have to know how to live with it, the way we are learning how to live with COVID-19, for example, some viruses.
Definitely.
So this is one of the virus, if we are not using it positively. So we have to know how
it
to protect ourselves.
So in another way, it is also a blessing of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
No doubt.
You know how many good works you can do with it just by single tap or with a single fingertip, you know. So alhamdulillah, a lot of people and a lot of, societies, they are using in a positive way. So especially for our young children and young, you know, our kids, we have to tell them, we have to show them that how to use in a right way, and especially our female, our wives and our sisters and our daughters, especially this can be dangerous for them.
So can you tell us that how it can be dangerous? Like, what is the difference between the real life and social media's life? You know, how Shaitan can easily deceive us in this area.
Yeah, when it comes to in our real life, you know, most of our religious families, they are cautious enough. Yeah, they take care of their own modesty, chastity, about their hijab and all these issues. They are cautious and they take care of it. But unfortunately, when it comes to social media, they may easily forget it. Because, you know, in social media, you are alone. You know, you have totally freedom. You can do whatever you want without letting them know who you are and what are you doing. So this is a big, big responsibility. But in our real life, you know, if you maybe you want to do something, but because of some restrictions, because of some people, because of some conditions, you can't do, you can't express whatever you want. Dear listeners, we will take a very short break. Inshallah, we'll come back soon.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are talking about modesty in our social media.
We all have so much worried fear about cancer, because cancer comes with you know, slowly and without any voice, and you
without
don't feel it. Yeah, it's
know,
a killer, but you know, silent killer. So the same way we can say this is the biggest challenge and danger for our day-to-day life, for especially for our faith, that the social media, if we cross the limits, it can kill us like a cancer, like for example sugar, you know, those kind of, you know, if you're just
those diseases, they do not have any symptoms. You do not know what kind of disease you have, they slowly damage from inside. So what a beautiful example. This social media, this technology can be a disease without any symptom. So, which is very difficult to know it and cure it.
And we know that how many sayings are there that, like, if you are just posting, for example, a picture without modesty and chastity, or if you are just talking to someone without having any limits, so that impact will remain until that picture is posted on social media, like generation after generation, because you don't know someone has maybe uploaded it. You know, you will delete it.
It on any website or in any platform.
So the danger of social media is, you know, out of our imagination. Sometimes we, you know, nowadays some people, they say, oh, we have just posted something, we didn't know that this our post has become very popular,
viral. And millions of people
and they couldn't even imagine about it. So in a good way you can do wonders, but unfortunately we have to be very careful about the positive, you know, impact of the social media. So I think the way nowadays we are so much careful about clean eating, like we have to eat very organic and clean
healthy
food, the same way we have to be very, very careful about clean watching, clean listening, clean eyes, clean heart. So I remember once I've done a workshop for our youth, youngsters, for our especially our girls, that clean heart we can reach to the clean heart position, qalb salim, which is our, you know, purpose of life,
goal,
with what? With clean screen.
Yeah.
If our screen is clean and healthy, then
because
we can
screen
reach.
Means our eyes, our thinking, our ears, you know. So definitely these are the sources of our inner purity.
Yeah.
If we give them spiritual and clean food, as you said, then definitely we can have that qalb salim, the pure heart, which is very, very difficult nowadays. So we are talking about modesty, for especially for a Muslim lady, yeah, because our program's name is Muslim Lady.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
We are talking about modesty in our social media. It has a lot of challenges, yeah, for a Muslim lady to how to, you know, manage and how to use in a positive way and how to, you know, walk on those limits and how not to cross these limits. So let's talk about the limits, you know. As you know, we have in our real life so many boundaries and limits, you know, about regarding our hijab and modesty, chastity, regarding our relationship. We all have boundaries, yeah. This kind of relationship is jaiz and allowed. This kind of relationship is not allowed. This kind of hijab is allowed. We have the same boundaries in social media. For example, is a Muslim lady allowed to post, first of all, a picture with hijab, for example, with proper hijab? Is she allowed to post a picture in social media, for example, in YouTube or in Facebook?
Yeah, very good question. Because, you know, if you refer to the Holy Book of Quran, Quran says, لا تبرجنا تبرج الجاهلية. Quran says, like, we shouldn't expose our beauty. Like, we shouldn't, like, if I'm looking very beautiful, maybe I'm in a very good hijab, but still, if I'm posing it, yeah, I'm showing it off. Like, for example, I'm showing off my new, maybe scarf or my new gown or something, you know, like just posting a picture as a modeling. You know, as a showing yourself is not according to modesty. But if you're just sitting in a very normal position, in a best form of hijab with family, and your aim is showing something else, you know, like you're just showing that, oh yeah, you are, for example, inside this university or showing university, or you're just there in the corner, then that would be not bad, you
know.
Yeah,
it is like modest.
Exactly. But sometimes, you know, some ladies, they are thinking that, because I'm covered, so I can just, you know, walk and show my walk. For example, if I can just stand, you know, I'm just posting my picture as a model. Modeling means, you know, like I'm just showing my figure with hijab. But that goes according to that ayat of Quran, verses of the Holy Book of Quran. Because you are just showing your scarf, showing your, for example, I don't know, new car, you're sitting on it, or I don't know, that kind of part with hijab, because, you know, that kind of title comes, which Islam is totally, you know, discouraging us. So, because otherwise we are just unconsciously we will cross the limits. I'll say, oh, I'm in hijab, let me smile. Sometimes, you know, they do modeling, they have some kind of catwalks with hijab, you know, that is so funny, unfortunately. So we can see nowadays our youngsters, they are totally confused, some of them, about the definition, you know, the value of hijab and modesty. They say, you know, she's also modest, you're also modest. For them, both are same, you know. But one is totally opposite of Islamic values and one is not.
Yeah.
But because, you know, they are just bombarded with so many strange way of, I don't know, we can say covering and hijab. So they get confused very easily. So we are responsible. You know,
yeah,
so it's a big responsibility.
Yeah.
Because of me, whole generation is getting confused because I'm posting those kind of pictures.
So Islam does not focus on our coverings only, yeah? If you have covered your hairs or your body, that is not enough.
Exactly.
Islam says you have to have a modest hijab. Modest hijab means your figures should not be exposed, you know? And your beauty should not be exposed also. So, unfortunately, we are running out of time again.
Yeah.
And this topic has a lot of, you know, questions and answers and a lot of things to discuss. So, inshallah, we will continue in our next episode.
Inshallah, why not? Because I think there are so many confusions about this very sensitive issue.
Until our next episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting, waiting for something, something to happen to me. This waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
The regimes that cry that they kill innocents by accident or unintentionally or because the terrorist shield behind them are also the ones that keep killing innocents, says Jonathan Cook, writer in an article titled Honest Mistakes, How U.S. U.S. and Israeli regime justify targeting and killing civilians. Stay tuned for more. Supposedly independent Pentagon inquiry this month claimed just such a good faith mistake after U.S. commanders authorized a drone strike in late August that killed an Afghan family, including seven children. A U.S. Air Force general concluded that there was no negligence or misconduct and that no disciplinary action should be taken. At the weekend, the Pentagon exonerated itself again. It called the 2019 air strike on the Baghouz in Syria that killed dozens of women and children justified. It did so even after an investigation by the New York Times showed that the group of civilians who were bombed had already been identified as fleeing fighting between U.S.-backed militias and Daesh. A U.S. military lawyer, Dean Corsack, flagged the incident at the time as a potential war crime, but the Pentagon never carried out an investigation. It came to public attention only because Corsack sent details to a Senate Oversight Committee. In announcing the conclusions of its Afghanistan inquiry, the Pentagon made clear what its true priorities are in the wake of its horrid Saigon-style exit from Afghanistan following two decades of failed occupation. It cares about image management, not accountability. Contrast its refusal to take action against the drone operators and commanders who fired on a civilian vehicle with the Pentagon's immediate crackdown on one of its troops who criticized the handling of the withdrawal. Veteran Marine Stuart Scheller was court-martialed last month after he used social media to publicly berate his bosses. Which of the two, Scheller's comment or the impunity of those who killed an innocent family, is likely to do more to discredit the role of the U.S. military in Afghanistan or other theaters around the globe in which it operates? Pentagon is far from alone in expecting to be exempt from scrutiny for its war crimes. The honest mistake is a continuing colonial narrative Western nations tell themselves and the rest of us when they kill civilians. When Western troops invade and occupy other people's lands and maybe help themselves to some of their resources, they find along the way it is done in the name of bringing security or spreading democracy. You're always the good guys, they are the evil ones. We make mistakes, they commit crimes. This is self-righteousness, is the source of Western indignation at any suggestion that the International Criminal Court at The Hague should investigate, let alone prosecute U.S., European, and Israeli regime commanders or politicians for carrying out or overseeing war crimes. The drone operators who killed the family of Zimari Ahmadi, an employee of a U.S. aid organization, were authorized to do so because his white Toyota Corolla was mistaken for a similar vehicle reported as belonging to the local franchise of Daesh. But that make is one of the most common vehicles in Afghanistan. The head of the aid organization where he worked told reporters pointedly, "I do not understand how the most powerful military in the world could follow Mr. Ahmadi, an aid worker, in a commonly used car for 8 hours and not figure out who he was and why he was at a U.S. aid organization's headquarters. The decision was at best recklessly indifferent as to whether Ahmadi was a genuine target and whether children would die as a result. But more likely, when it attacked Ahmadi's vehicle, the entire U.S. military system was in the grip of a blinding thirst for revenge. 3 days earlier, 13 American troops and 169 Afghan civilians had been killed when a bomb exploded close to Kabul airport as Afghans master in the hope of gaining a place on one of the last evacuation flights. final military humiliation, this one inflicted by Daesh, after the Taliban effectively chased American troops out of Afghanistan. Revenge, even when it is dressed up as restoring deterrence or military honor, is not an honest mistake. But there is an even deeper reason to be skeptical of the Pentagon inquiry. There is no honest mistake defense when the same mistakes keep happening. Honest mistakes can't be a pattern of behavior. And yet the long years of U.S. occupation of Afghanistan and Iraq and meddling in Syria have been pockmarked with airstrikes that obliterated families or slammed into wedding parties. That information rarely makes headlines, eclipsed by the Pentagon's earlier faulty claims of successful neutralization of terrorists. But just such mistakes were the reason why the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan ultimately imploded. The Pentagon's scattergun killing of Afghans created so many enemies among the local population that U.S.-backed local rulers lost all legitimacy. Something similar happened during the U.S. and U.K.'s occupation of Iraq. Anyone who believes the Pentagon commits honest mistakes when it kills civilians needs to watch the video Collateral Murder issued by WikiLeaks in 2012. It shows the aerial view of helicopter pilots in 2007 as they discuss with a mix of technical indifference and gruesome glee their missile strikes on a crowd of Iraqis, including two Reuters journalists moving about on the streets of Baghdad below. When a passing van tries to come to the aid of one of the wounded, the pilots fire again, even though a child is visible in the front seat. In fact, two children were found inside the van. U.S. troops arriving at the scene made the decision to deny both treatment from U.S. physicians. As the pilots were told of the casualties, one commented, "Well, it's their fault for bringing their kids into a battle." The other responded, "That's right." Before the video was leaked, the military claimed that civilians killed that day had been caught in the crossfire of a gun battle. There is no question that coalition forces were clearly engaged in combat operations against a hostile force, a statement read. The video, however, shows that there was nothing honest or mistaken about the way those Iraqis died, even if there was no specific intention to kill civilians. They were killed because U.S. commanders were uninterested in the safety of those it occupied, because they were indifferent to whether Iraqis, even Iraqi children, lived or die. The regimes that cry loudest that they kill innocents by accident or unintentionally or because the terrorists shield behind them are also the ones that keep killing innocents. The Israeli regime's version of this is the tragic mistake. The excuse is used in 2014 when its navy fired two precision missiles at a beach in Gaza at exactly the spot where four boys were playing football. They were killed instantly. In 7 weeks of pummeling Gaza in 2014, the Israeli regime killed more than 500 Palestinian children and more than 850 adult civilians. And yet all were apparently honest mistakes, because no troops, commanders or politicians were ever held to account for those deaths. Palestinian civilians keep dying year after year, decade after decade, and yet they are always killed by an honest mistake. The Israeli regime's excuses are entirely unconvincing for the same reason the Pentagon's carry no weight. Both have committed their crimes in another people's territory to which they have not been invited. Both militaries rule over those people without good cause, treating the local population as hostile, and both act in knowledge that their troops enjoy absolute impunity. In reaching its decision on the killing of the Afghan family this month, the Pentagon stated that it had not broken the law. That verdict, too, is not honest. What the U.S. military means is that it did not break its own self-serving rules of engagement, rules that permit anything the U.S. military decides it wants to do. It behaves if no law applies to it when it invades other lands, not even the laws of territories it occupies. That argument is dishonest, too. There are the laws of war and the laws of occupation. There is international law. The U.S. has broken those laws over and over again in Afghanistan and Iraq, as has the Zionist regime, in ruling over the Palestinians for more than 5 decades and blockading parts of their territory. The problem is that there is no appetite to enforce international law against the planet's sole military superpower and its allies. Instead, it is allowed to claim the role of benevolent global policeman. And the Israeli regime declined to ratify the Rome Statute, which established the International Criminal Court, ICC, that judges war crimes. That refusal was no honest mistake either. Each expected to avoid the court's scrutiny. U.S. and Israeli regime leaders know their troops commit war crimes, and that they themselves commit war crimes by approving either the wars of aggression these troops are expected to wage or the messy, long-term belligerent occupations they are supposed to enforce. But whatever they hope, the failure to ratify the statute does not serve as a stay-out-of-jail card. U.S. and Israeli regime leaders still risk falling under the ICC's jurisdiction if the countries they invade or occupy have ratified the statute, as is the case with Afghanistan and Palestine. The catch is that the Hague Court can be used only as a last resort. In other words, it has to be shown first that any country accused of war crimes failed to seriously investigate those crimes itself. The chorus from the U.S. and Israeli regime of honest mistake every time they kill civilians is just such proof. It demonstrates that the U.S. and Israeli regime systems are entirely incapable of upholding laws of war or holding their own political and military officials to account. That must be the job of ICC instead. But the court is fearful. The Trump administration launched the war against it last year to stop its officials investigating U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. The assets of the court's officials were blocked and they were denied the right to enter the U.S. That is the reason why the court keeps failing to stand up for the victims of Western war crimes like Zimari Ahmadi and his children. The ICC had spent 15 years dragging its feet before it finally announced last year that it would investigate allegations of U.S. war crimes in Afghanistan. That resolve quickly dissolved under the subsequent campaign of pressure. In September, shortly after Ahmadi's family was killed by U.S. drone operators, the court's chief prosecutor declared that investigations into U.S. actions in Afghanistan, including widespread claims of torture of Afghans, would be deprioritized. The investigation would focus instead on Taliban and Daesh. Once again, enemies of the United States, but not the United States itself, will be called to account. That, too, is no honest mistake.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.